Last case on our calendar today is A23-0842, State of Minnesota versus Camille Lachey Dennis Bond. Counsel will each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. Appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I will ask that you please introduce yourself and the party you represent at the beginning of the argument. I'll also note for everyone who's attending here today that we are recording the oral argument. An audio recording will be available on our website, usually within 24 hours. We're also live streaming the argument. To anyone who's watching, I'll just remind you that no recordings of the oral arguments are permitted except with the express prior permission of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Travis Kyle, that's spelled K-E-I-L, and I represent the appellant, Ms. Camille Dennis Bond. We're here today because at appellant's trial, the state violated the defendant's right to equal protection by striking juror number 7, who was an African-American juror, when considering analyzing the other strikes that they did not use, specifically against juror number 24, who was a white juror, was almost considerably identical to juror number 7.
Counsel, wasn't there a distinction as to how they answered the question regarding fault to the driver and the accidents they were in?
I don't believe so, because if you look at juror number 24, juror number 24 takes absolutely no accountability for their driving conduct. And juror number 24 is the white juror who was kept on. When questioned, juror number 24 blamed that on a stop sign, when in fact, juror number 24 specifically stated, I'm driving in an area that I am not familiar with, it's sparse. Didn't indicate in any follow-up or provide any information that, hey, I'm in an area I don't know, I should be a little more cautious to make sure other vehicles I don't strike. Whereas juror 7 specifically told the court and the parties, listen, I was following a student driver. I thought he was going to drive through the yellow. I was following too closely. They braked. I hit him. And in fact, on the questions by the state, juror number 7 says, yes, throughout time I've learned to keep more distance between drivers. So juror 7 is actually taking accountability for their actions, whereas juror 24 is saying, I didn't do anything wrong here.
And so, counsel, with respect to juror 24, correct me if I'm wrong, but in my review of the transcript at the district court level, I didn't see any argument about juror 24 with regard to the Batson challenge.
Well, I didn't see that either in the transcript, Judge.
So is that argument properly before us?
I think it is, because when one of the ways in which the court can analyze purposeful discrimination is to show that a party's proffered reason for striking a prospective juror applies equally to similar prospective jurors. And here we're arguing that when you compare those two, that juror 24 is almost identical to juror 7, except that juror 7 takes accountability, whereas juror 24, doesn't.
But given our standard of review, shouldn't that argument have been made to the district court?
Well, I think looking at the three-step tier in terms of a Batson challenge is first the defendant or whoever is making the Batson challenge would make that standard, make that motion that there's a Batson issue. And as long as they make that, then the state would follow up with reasoning why it's race neutral, and then the court would go into reasoning why they essentially find that it either is race neutral or not. And here the court gave basically a two-sentence answer that basically what was proffered by the state is race neutral. And I think probably what it seemed to happen is they struck juror 7 before they got to juror number 24. So if you're making the argument to juror 7 and you don't know that juror 24 is not going to be struck, then how can you raise that issue? So I think here it's properly before the court. I think it's clear from the transcript here that this was an issue where appellant was denied her equal protection because of that. And then when you, it's extremely important when you really analyze and look at the transcript here, they are almost identical as I've stated, except the accountability by juror 24 is obsolete, and he is left on that jury. And we're talking about a fairly...
Counsel, you argue that the accountability with respect to juror 7 is obsolete, but I think that juror 7, I'm trying to pull up the exact part of the transcript, but when asked if he felt that he was 100% at fault for the accident, he didn't agree to that.
I think, yeah, and it's not...
Before you answer that, let me go further. He goes on to say, I mean, personally, I thought they could have just continued instead of hitting the brakes right away. It sounds to me like he's acknowledging that he's not totally at fault, that they had a part in it and maybe caused it.
I think what he's doing is just describing, I think, what fairly most drivers do on the roadway is that, you know, a stop sign, or it's not a stop sign, a speed sign says 55, but a lot of drivers will drive 60. And here, this is a situation where the light was yellow. It's not uncommon for drivers to try to beat the yellow light. And he said he thought the driver was going to go through, which appears from his experience drivers would. And he was following too close and acknowledged that in follow-up that he's learned through the years that he obviously needs to keep more distance between drivers in front of him and so he can properly brake.
Well, I think the tenor of his remarks, and we can continue on here, but the tenor of his remarks, he mentions it's an instructor with a student driver, and he suggests that they played a significant part in that accident.
I think initially that came across in the transcript, but when it's followed up, you know, the state asks, who's a better driver, a 17-year-old self or a 22-year-old self? And he follows up, but I think being aware and giving people distance is definitely something I've learned over time, which is acknowledging that I've learned that I can't stay or can't be as close to drivers because you can never tell how a driver's going to react to a situation, especially if you're assuming the driver in front of you is going to try to get through the yellow. You're not in his mind. You don't know what he's doing. And if they brake and you're too close, you don't leave yourself enough room to brake. So I didn't interpret his statement to say that he's passing the blame. I think what he's talking about is just a real-life experience that he thought from past experience the driver was going to try to drive through and he would follow. And, in fact, the driver didn't, and that caused the accident. But if you compare that to juror 24, juror 24 says it's the stop sign's fault.
Well, but juror 24 asked if it had been clear and the juror T-boned the car, would it have been the juror 24's fault? And juror 24 said yes. So,
I didn't quite make that out. Could you repeat that, please?
Oh, my memory of juror 24 is that juror 24 went on to say, testified that if the stop sign had been clear and juror 24 had still T-boned the car, juror 24 acknowledged that it would have been juror 24's fault. So I think there is a distinction.
But I think that...
And the standard of review is very high. It's, you know, clear error.
And I understand that, but I think when you compare these two side by side, juror 7 takes accountability. It's not like he is passing 100% of the blame onto the driver in front of him. And when the state uses a peremptory challenge on an African-American juror who's the same race as the defendant and on juror 24 who causes an accident and says it's the stop sign's fault because I couldn't see it, even though he acknowledges being in an area where I am unfamiliar with, and it's a sparse area, continue to drive, it doesn't appear that he's taking any responsibility that maybe he should have been on the lookout a little bit more for that.
Isn't there a distinction between blaming the other driver, which I think number 7 suggested at least the other driver was partially responsible, and not blaming the other driver, goes on to say I T-boned that car, and blaming outside circumstances? I mean, this case involved two cars hitting. So we're not dealing with, I realize what you're saying in terms of the stop sign, but it's not quite the same as suggesting that the other driver was responsible too.
No, but instead of you saying the other driver's responsible, he's trying to blame it on whoever is supposed to keep the maintenance. So it's trying to pass blame onto someone else and not doing any kind of reflection, because when you look at what the state's central argument was and why they struck the juror is, I could just have a moment to pull that up. He says, when we got to the point of having a discussion on whose fault that was, he really, and refers to juror number 7, really struck to his guns that a large part of this could have been avoided if the driver ahead of him would have simply gone through the intersection. He did not, in any of his questions, as the state recalls, talk about what he could have been done differently. So when you apply what the state is telling the court, why they struck juror 7, that same rationale can be applied to juror 24, the white juror, because he's sticking to his gun, saying it's the stop sign's fault. It's not my fault. I have no duty to look out for oncoming traffic or see what's there. And he stuck to his guns. And in fact, the state really didn't press him on that issue either. Kind of left it open-ended, so to speak.
Counsel, I understand why a Batson challenge was brought here. You'd have to bring one, absolutely, in this kind of a case. And certainly made a prima facie case of discrimination. So the issue is whether it's a race neutral explanation. You don't feel it is, obviously. I'm sure your client, your opponent feels differently. But we're using up a lot of your time, so maybe we should move on.
Yeah. And so in getting to the second part of the argument in terms of causation, I think a lot of this was summed up essentially in closing arguments and obviously in our briefs. But, you know, this is a situation where two vehicles were driving. Obviously, the testimony came out on trial that both cars were driving at a fairly high rate of speed. And the question before is did appellant's vehicle was a substantial cause of that? And when you look at the evidence that was provided to the jury, appellant's car makes it through the stop sign. The intervening factor is the other driver, appellant's brother, who was a juvenile, was driving at a high rate of speed. Appellant has no control over juvenile brother's decision-making, how they control the car, how they operate it, what their viewpoint is. And then as appellant gets through that stoplight, you then have the vehicle that was struck, which is a superseding, takes a left. And the testimony that came out of trial was this vehicle took a left, kept the same speed. There's no testimony or evidence that that vehicle's viewpoint was obstructed, but essentially took a left into oncoming traffic. And it was, co-defendant, appellant's brother, whose vehicle struck this vehicle, was the one that did it. And appellant was well past that stoplight, had no control over how the appellant or the appellant's brother was driving or operating that vehicle.
Mr. Kyle, the state relies on the CPW case from this court in 1999, which had similar facts. Do you have a rebuttal to that?
Well, I think in this case, when you look at the facts, you have a vehicle turning into, and appellant is well beyond that. Again, appellant, I think the crux of this is appellant has no control over any of the other drivers. And I think it's crucial to understand that that is a significant point, because if someone says, let's jump off a bridge together, and you listen to that person, is the other person should be liable for telling that person to do it?
But did in CPW, was that not true?
Well, I think it was true, but I just, when I look at the facts of this case, I see some differences. I think specifically, I just look at that appellant is controlling her vehicle, driving at the rate of speed she was driving at, and it's her brother that strikes this vehicle, is going at excessive speed, could have stopped, instead tries to swerve to get around it, smacks into the car, and then it's this car taking a left onto oncoming traffic. It wasn't that like this car had a green light and these cars were running stoplights. They were in their lane of traffic.
Are you arguing that the CRV was a superseding cause, the turn?
CRV?
Wasn't the car that was hit a CRV?
Yes, I believe, I'm arguing that is a super...
Well, given the speeding, I think the district court found that with, given the speeding, it wasn't a superseding cause.
What's that?
Was the, given the, that the parties were speeding, the record reflects that the parties were speeding, how is the car that took the left a superseding cause in this case?
Well, I think the car taking a left into oncoming traffic, there's at least minimal duty to at least see if there's traffic coming. One can't just
but
turn
how in. Can you anticipate that the traffic is going to be, you know, more approximately twice the speed limit, going at almost 100 miles per hour?
When you turn left, if you're turning left, you would see oncoming traffic, and you would still maintain a lookout when you're turning left. You, as a driver, your obligations are to look at all surround. You don't just have horse blinders on and just look straight. And if this vehicle is turning and sees vehicles coming at a high rate of speed, could have braked, could have sped up to get through it, but instead they just turned left. And I see I only have 10 seconds left, so I will take my seat. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Mr. Kyle, my name is Heather Pippenhagen. I'm an assistant Dakota County attorney, and I'm here on behalf of the state of Minnesota, the respondent in this matter. Both appellant's convictions and appellant's sentence should be affirmed in this case. The district court did not clearly err when it denied the Batson challenge, and the district court did not abuse its discretion in sentencing. And the evidence in this case overwhelmingly supported the jury's verdicts. And I'll address those in the order raised in appellant's brief. As far as the Batson challenge, we've spent a lot of time on that, so I won't do that again. But obviously the central issue in this case was causation. So in addressing the Batson challenge, the state definitely provided a race-neutral reason. I heard appellants say today that the reason provided wasn't race-neutral. The reason provided certainly was race-neutral, and that was that juror number 7 attributed some of the fault of the accident to the other driver when that was not the case, at least in the state's position based on the description of the accident. I know appellant focused heavily on the accountability of the driver, but what the state was focusing on when it responded was the attributing causation to the other driver. And that's what juror number 7 did, and that is definitely a race-neutral reason and clearly is related to the facts of the case, which is also required in that second prong of the Batson analysis.
Should we consider juror 24 in our analysis of this issue?
That was not argued to the district court, so the district court wasn't provided an opportunity to compare the responses of those two different jurors. So I would say no. But even if you do, that argument fails. There is a very clear distinction between juror number 24 and juror number 7. As I indicated, the state's focus explained its reason for the strike was on the attributing fault to the other driver when it wasn't really warranted. Juror number 24 didn't do that at all. Juror number 24 felt it wasn't her fault because she couldn't see the stop sign, but never attributed any fault to the driver that she hit, and in fact said had she seen the stop sign, the accident would have been her fault. So I think that is a distinction that you can make even if you do consider that argument. And then moving to the third prong of the Batson analysis, I know it was stated that the district court judge didn't make much of a finding, but the district court judge did address all three prongs of the Batson challenge. They said the state provided a race-neutral reason for the strike and went on to say that then, moving to the third prong, appellant had not met its burden to show that the challenge was actually motivated by racial discrimination and that the stated reason wasn't pretextual. So the district court properly conducted the Batson analysis, and there was no clear error in that portion of the trial. And moving to the sufficiency of the evidence, again, it's about causation and proximate cause. The evidence clearly established in this case that appellant was jointly with the co-defendant the proximate cause of the death of two people. The evidence showed that appellant, and is exactly what the law requires, played a substantial part in bringing about their death. And appellant in this case and the co-defendant, LB, just like the defendants in CPW, jointly engaged in conduct that demonstrated a conscious disregard for the safety of everybody around them, including the passengers in their own vehicles. And just a couple of comments, factual comments that I feel like I need to correct from appellant's argument. First of all, there was a statement that when this accident occurred, appellant was well past the stoplight and had cleared the accident. If you watch this video, which I'm sure you have and you'll have the opportunity to do, that is absolutely not correct. That's what she said in her statement to the police, but the video does not support that. The video shows they were right next to each other and she barely missed hitting the victim's vehicle. So she had not cleared the intersection. It just happened to be LB's vehicle that collided with the victim's. And
was the left-hand turn by the other vehicle a superseding cause?
It was not. It does not satisfy the four different elements that are required for superseding cause. But the more concerning part of that argument is that's not the argument that was made in the brief. The argument that was made in the brief is that LB's collision with the victim's vehicle was a superseding intervening cause. So that is the argument that I responded to in my brief. Here in oral argument is the first time I've heard an argument that the driver turning was the intervening superseding cause. But I can certainly address that if the court would like, looking at the four elements of that. I can tell you two of them will not be satisfied, that it wasn't brought about by the original negligence, it wasn't reasonably foreseeable by the original wrongdoer. When you're traveling over 100 miles an hour down the road, first of all, you don't have the right of way anymore, and the person that needs to turn in front of you is not able to accurately gauge the speed that you're coming at them with. And we heard that testimony even from a civilian witness that was able to make that evaluation, and then from the expert accident reconstructionist in this case. So, you know, even if you address that argument that was just made for the first time, an oral argument, it does not amount to a superseding intervening cause that relieves her of the liability in this case. And then moving to the third issue, which is the sentence in this case, I know we haven't gotten to that yet, but I just want to comment, there was no abuse of discretion in the sentence here. The district court imposed concurrent guideline sentences.
Counsel, as to that sentence, would you agree criminal vehicle or homicide is a lesser included in murder three?
I don't think that was part of the argument in this brief, correct? I guess I didn't do a lesser.
It's our obligation if there's mistake in a sentence.
I guess I didn't do a lesser included analysis. On the spot, I would say it is not. I think the elements are different. And the criminal, and one of the criminal vehicular operation counts also related to a third victim, the victim that was.
Yeah, injured. I'm not referencing that. I'm referencing
Okay.
Homicide.
I would say, without having more time to look at it, and I'm sorry, I didn't know you were going to ask that. I don't think that it is. I think that would have been addressed at sentencing. We certainly wouldn't have sentenced or convicted on that if that were the case. But in this case, the district court imposed guidelines concurrent sentences in a case where the killing of two people would have authorized the court to impose permissive consecutive sentences. So This was not an abuse of discretion. I think the court analyzed amenability to probation very well in the transcript, and just any argument that her conduct was less severe than the typical offense when it resulted in the death of two people simply also is not supported, and there was no abuse of discretion. And I know we're running behind. If the panel doesn't have any other questions, I would forfeit the rest of my minutes here.
Is CPW, the case that you cite in your brief, is that distinguishable here on the facts?
No, it is not. I mean, I think this case is right on. These two, based on the evidence, and you look at the facts in the light that support the verdict, and I think this is what the jury heard and the jury believed. There was an agreement, a conversation over the windows, and an agreement to engage in this race. CPW might not even have so much, it's not clear because we don't know the facts of that case, but it wasn't where the parties, there's no support in that case, the facts we have of it, that there was actually a mutual joint agreement to engage in the conduct. We don't know what led to the chase. But in this case, there certainly was an agreement between the parties to engage in this grossly negligent behavior. So if there's any distinction, I would say this case is worse in that regard.
Seeing no further questions, thank you.
So just briefly on, on rebuttal, there is mention here that there is a mutual agreement to race. I think there was testimony at the trial from the passenger of appellant's vehicle that there was no mutual agreement to race. Essentially, the facts came out. There was other testimony that there was, but I think what came about is that both vehicles were speeding at a high rate of speed. As for the Batson challenge argument, again, it's not just pointing and saying juror 7 didn't take fault and took no accountability. It's that juror 24 also didn't take accountability. That's the point in this argument, is that you have two jurors, one black, one white. They're both not taking accountability, or at least juror 7 did take some accountability and said, I've learned to keep distance, whereas juror 24 again says, it's the stop sign's fault. It's not my fault. I don't have any duty to look out with what's going on here. It's just solely because whoever is supposed to maintain a stop sign didn't do that. And in terms of...
So just to be clear, I think you mentioned that it's proper to consider juror 24, even though juror 24 wasn't mentioned at the time of the juror 7 Batson challenge, but how could the district court have, considered that in its evaluation, and aren't we to look at how the district court analyzed the issue and determine whether its decision was clearly erroneous?
Well, I think that's kind of part of the problem with the court not providing their findings was very minimal, because the court is sitting there through the trial, through the jury selection, hearing all this, and the judge hears this information. So we're going solely off of what's in the transcript, and judge presumably is sitting there listening and heard juror 24, because in fact he did question juror 24, because they initially started voir dire, bringing certain jurors in individually, which juror 7 and juror 24 were, because they filled out the questionnaire and highlighted information, namely being involved in accidents, and that's why they were questioned individually outside the whole panel of the jury. So in terms of the causation argument, you're going to see the video. It's in your eyes to determine if appellant is there. It's my opinion appellant was through that. In terms of sentencing, I think the judge did abuse his discretion. Here you have a 19-year-old appellant with no criminal history, cooperated throughout the process, had all the trog factors, as was outlined at sentencing, were met. I mean, she had remorse. She had no criminal record. I think all those factors point to that she was particularly amenable to probation. I understand that, obviously, there's a loss of life and it's serious, but her vehicle was not the vehicle that struck, and that kind of ties into the less onerous factor that she is not the primary cause, and that came out at testimony from Sergeant Dixon, who was the reconstruction expert who came in and said the primary cause was her brother who struck the
vehicle.
That
isn't the standard, correct?
Well, the standard is less onerous, different than other similar situations. And if you take the same situation, if she's the driver that struck the vehicle, she's the one controlling the vehicle. It's her obligation on the lookout. So she is not the one who struck the vehicle. And I think based upon those facts, it's less onerous because although if the court determines that they were racing, she was not the one that struck this vehicle. It was her brother who struck the vehicle due to his lack of control. As Sergeant Dixon said, he decides it's his driving conduct that actually hits the vehicle. And if he would have driven differently, you wouldn't have had an accident. If he would have stopped, there wouldn't be an accident here. And I think that that would definitely meet the standard of less onerous, because you could have similar situations where there's other people participating in a crime, but their role is minimal compared to the actual person, the actual perpetrator who committed the crime. And I think in that situation here, I think that standard would be met, that it's obviously less onerous than other similar situations. And I see I have a few seconds left and wanted to answer any other questions the court may have.
Doesn't appear there are any further questions, so thank you for your argument
here
today. Thank you to both counsel. We will look carefully at the issues in this case and issue our opinion within the statutory time frame.
Thank you.
That completes our calendar for today. We are now in recess.